Okay, gang, cut the gas. You're gonna flip your lids when you see the swell idea the nerds have come up with. Please pick up your tins. Now, you'll see that they're connected by string, and when you talk in that end, Polly, David over here can hear you. Isn't that the cat's pajamas? Don't be a wet rag now, Polly. Say hello.
Hello, Dave.
You see? No sweat.
Times have changed. So should your PBX. Get Virto from Vox Orion, a hosted IP PBX for your business that offers fantastic savings from 65 Rand per user per month. For more info, SMS your name to 45678.
And we'll call you.
Welcome to Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by South Africa's technology news leader at techcentral.co.za. I'm Duncan McLeod. I'm here with Craig Wilson. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Duncan.
So I'm finally back after a very exhausting trip to CES in Las Vegas. Good to be home.
It sounds real busy, but some highlights in between.
It was indeed a very interesting show. I think we'll get to that just now. But I know you have to run quite soon, so we're going to keep the show quite tight this week. So let's delve straight into it. There's been some really big news happening on the local front. I think the biggest news was the appointment of Alan Knott Craig. Not completely unexected.
No, there have been some predictions and murmurs.
Yes, indeed. As the new CEO of Cell C, taking over from Lars Reichelt, who left last year. Alan Knott Craig, of course. I don't think anyone listening to the show needs
a reminder of his background.
Yeah. But, of course, the former CEO of Vodacom, the founding CEO of Vodacom. He was there for more than 15 years. And he's been on gardening leave, effectively, under restraint for the last three and a half years. That expires on the 1st of April, at which point he'll be taking over at Vodacom rival Cell C.
Indeed.
And certainly an interesting development, going from the biggest operator in the country to the third biggest, highly respected individual. In terms of his ability to build businesses. So it's going to be fascinating to watch what he does with Cell C and whether he is able to use perhaps some of that competitive advantage he has over Vodacom.
Indeed, and known to be an individual who likes to shake things up and shake the status quo, and not always necessarily the easiest, but it's going to be a very interesting sort of couple of months. And of course, Cell C had a great run last year or in recent years under Lars Reichelt, who's now sort of left the scene entirely, or the industry entirely for the time being. And it'll be nice to sort of build on that momentum.
Definitely. I mean, Lars did a really good job of reinvigorating the network, of building a third generation network, which they simply didn't have before, which is kind of hard to believe now.
Yes.
And they're going to... sorry, I'm losing my track of thought here. So, you know, he did a lot of work on the network and building it out, and also on the marketing side of things, rebranding Cell C and really getting it out in the face of consumers. Cell C wasn't really a well-known or even a well-respected brand in the South African market.
No.
I think that really changed under Lars Reichelt. Now, Alan Knott Craig has been appointed, and I think that his strengths are going to add to the organization. He's specifically talking up, making sure the network is robust, and then building Cell C's distribution channels, where of course he has a great deal of strength, where he helped build South Africa's cell phone distribution channels at Vodacom.
Right.
So he's going to bring a lot of expertise there, and it's one area where Cell C has arguably been weak, is in distribution.
Right. And there's also been talk, he was talking about the importance of innovating on a sort of services offering front.
Yes.
Talking about, you know, not looking at operators purely as providers of telephony services, but
yes,
that they need to expand their horizons if they're going to keep profitability up, particularly in line with falling voice revenues and ARPUs, which are sort of affecting all of the operators.
Yes. In my interaction with him, he particularly... punted social media and social networking as a key area for mobile operators going forward. So one wonders what he's going to do in this space. Of course, his son recently bought Mixit, which is one of the country's biggest, if not the biggest social network, South African social network. So I wonder if we're going to see a deal on that front.
Some sort of overlap, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, this seems to be the season. There have been a number of changes, people leaving and moving. And
yes,
it seems the beginning of the year, a fresh start, people are being hired and fired left, right, and center.
It always happens.
Designing.
It always happens at this time of year. And I guess a lot of guys go away on holiday and sort of think about their careers and where they are in their lives. And
or perhaps even been thinking about it for a few months, and it seems a sensible time to make the break. Yeah,
indeed. And we've seen a number of moves. The CEO of Incredible Connection, Dave Miller, has stepped down.
Indeed, also announced this week, yeah.
Yeah, and of course the biggie is Jeffrey Hedberg leaving Eltek. Jeffrey, of course, being the former CEO, acting CEO of Telkom, and before that, CEO of Cell C.
I say, yes, there's all these overlaps, and he has a similarly sort of illustrious history.
Yes.
And that one, of course, is a little more controversial. Eltek's had a rather bad run of late,
executives. They've lost a lot of top executives in the recent past. Craig Fenter, I've been trying to have a conversation with Craig Fenter today, but we keep missing each other on the phone. Craig Fenter, of course, the CEO of Eltek. Suggestions that I've picked up from various people in the market is that Fenter's alleged abrasive management style has rubbed up the wrong way of a lot of these executives, which is why they've left. I must emphasize, I'm still to have a conversation with Craig Fenter about it. But,
indeed, it'll be interesting to see what he says, and we'll certainly have something up about that once we've managed to track him down.
Certainly, but they've lost a lot of top executives. Andy Baker, the former chief operating officer, left. He went to Nashua. In fact, he's now just been appointed. He's left Nashua and has now just been appointed as the new CEO for Africa for Group 4 Security. So he's leaving the telecoms industry altogether. But other top executives like Ashraf Parukh, who, if I'm not mistaken, used to work at MTN. He was chief technology officer at Eltek. And we've seen James Rutherford, who was head of the telecommunications division, leaving, and he's now running Nokia in West Africa, and a number of other people. So if I was an Eltek shareholder, I'd probably be a little bit concerned about the
rate of change,
the rate of turnover of top management at Eltek, and I think it's going to be very interesting to take a look at Eltek's next set of financial results, because we all know that they were performing poorly up in the Kenyan operation. Craig Fenter replaced the management team up there, promised to turn it around in short order, but now Jeffrey Hedberg has left, who was going to be managing overseeing a lot of that turnaround. So the next set of financial results are going to be quite interesting to take a look at.
Indeed, and very telling, yeah.
Cool. Right, quite sad news this week, if you're a camera buff. Kodak filed for bankruptcy protection. I know, Craig, you've been looking at the story in quite some detail today.
I have, yeah.
What's behind it? Why Kodak? Why have they gone under and some other companies are really succeeding in the digital camera market?
Well, and it's really fascinating. It's particularly fascinating when you look at Kodak in conjunction with Fujifilm, which for many years, particularly in the 70s and 80s, was their sort of only real rival. And that, in the film business. Mm. And it seems it's a combination of bad luck, a head in the sand, and complacency. You know, Kodak absolutely dominated the industry, particularly in the US. Some of the figures I've seen were, things like in 1976, they had as much as 90% of film sales in the US were Kodak, and 85% of cameras.
Wow.
Which, when you think how comparatively, segmented that market is today, it's just absolutely phenomenal that someone could have quite such a monopoly. The model was interesting early on. They were one of the early sort of Gillette or, HP printers or any printers, sort of the idea that, you could sell the original product at virtually a loss and recoup on consumables.
Mm.
And really, it was a business of consumables. The problem was, of course, in the digital age, those consumables don't exist.
Mm.
Fuji, meanwhile, has gone on to build a very successful digital company, digital camera business, and has diversified and found some other uses for some of its patents. Kodak, meanwhile, thought that its vast, vast array of patents for various chemicals would prove valuable, but unfortunately they haven't. And
did you say chemicals?
Chemicals, yeah. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. All of the processing chemicals and so on. They own thousands of patents for different chemicals, but very few of these are in use anymore.
Right.
And they haven't been able to adapt them. Even I haven't read that they a lot of film includes collagen. And so both Fuji and Kodak explored various beauty products. Fuji actually has a range called, I think it's called Astrolift, that's out in Asia and is launching in Europe next month.
Sounds like a woman's beauty product.
Indeed, I think that's exactly what it is. But yeah, Kodak just seems to have made a number of bad choices over the years. The other thing I've learned today is that it's continued to be involved in the digital business.
Right.
But it hasn't positioned itself in such a way that people are aware of this. It's made a number of sensors for a number of manufacturers over the years. And, when we stop and think about it, sensors are the equivalent of 35 millimeter or any sort of film.
Yes.
The problem is, it's merely a component. in much the way that, you know, Samsung makes parts for Apple phones, you still think of them as Apple phones, not Samsung phones. And this is the problem with Kodak. Kodak may make some sensors, but no one thinks about Kodak compact cameras.
Mm-hmm.
They do make a small range of them, but they've never done particularly well or gotten any particularly critical acclaim. And it's here again where Fuji's shown them how it really should be done.
So what did they do wrong? Why didn't they crack the digital camera market with that powerful brand that they had back in the 70s and 80s?
Incredibly powerful brand. For a long time, they also seemed to rest on their laurels and think that emerging markets who were continuing to buy film into the early digital era would keep that business alive. And they seemed to underestimate, bizarrely and foolishly, just how appealing digital photography would be. They certainly saw it coming. You know, there are even mentions of internal reports written by Kodak staff saying, predicting that by 2010, which was perhaps a little bit too soon, but predicting that digital was inevitably the future. Unbelievably, they don't seem to have listened. It's just bizarre. It's just a series of bad decisions and not positioning themselves as an image supplier. They still seem to cling to this notion of being a film manufacturer.
Right.
And it's just some of the decisions are absolutely staggering. Another fun one I read was, you know, for a long time, until the mid-80s, Fuji only really had any traction in Asia.
Right.
And Kodak had essentially the rest of the developed world. And in 1984, Kodak dithered and dragged its heels about sponsorship for the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics. And Fuji was appointed the sponsor. And suddenly Fuji had a foot in the US door at one of the most, you know, widely broadcast events and on Kodak's home turf. And those sort of errors of judgment, cumulatively, it seems that there just seems to have been so many of these small, poor calls that it dug itself into a hole it can't escape.
Right. I'm sure there are going to be lots of business books and management case studies at business schools about
how not to
manage a transition to
exactly. And it's a great reminder. You know, when you see, it reminds me of most recently of a company like Nokia, and you think of Nokia's absolute dominance a decade ago. And, you know, meanwhile, Nokia, unlike Kodak, seems to have woken up in time and be making the effort to change it. But I think that's exactly it. This will be taught in business schools for many years to come. But, of course, it's bizarre to think that, our children will... Kodak will won't mean anything by the looks of it.
Yeah, it'll just be in history books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating, yeah. Of course, BlackBerry is another case study, research in motion.
Indeed.
They may be reacting even slower to Nokia than to the market change. But it's interesting, as technology, the pace of technology increases, so does the window for these long-established companies to actually... to write their businesses and get the right products out there. It's Kodak had a long time to rethink its business.
They had plenty of warning, but this also seems to be the problem. Is sometimes the companies, these enormous companies, don't move quickly enough. Mm. They're simply not maneuverable, and they're so sort of bogged down with red tape that they don't see the importance of constant, ongoing, ceaseless innovation.
Yes, the same thing, of course, happened to IBM back in the late 80s or early 90s, and they had to shed tens or if not even hundreds of thousands of jobs,
And then reposition themselves as an
enterprise services company rather than a maker of tin.
Sure.
And Lou Gerstner, of course, rescued that business. Anyway, Craig, we need to take a quick break there. We'll be back right after these messages from our sponsors.
After the advent of the telephone, it took mankind 70 years to invent the color television. And yet, it only took the next 23 years to invent lasers, the internet, to put a man on the moon. Ignition sequence start. It begs the question, what will the business world be like in the next 23 years? Wherever your business is at, Telkom Business will be there with you. Telkom Business.
Switchboard. Why, hey, Sunshine. Let me transfer you. Please hold. Switchboard. Why, I'm just Peachy. Thanks for asking. Please hold. Switchboard. Oh, dang. He's just stepped out of his office. Can I transfer you? Please hold. Bill! It's your wife!
Times have changed. So should your PBX. Get Virto from Vox Orion, a hosted IP PBX for your business available from only 65 Rand per user per month. For more info, SMS your name to 45678.
And we'll call you.
Welcome back to Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by South Africa's technology news leader at techcentral.co.za. I'm Duncan McLeod, and as always, I'm here with Craig Wilson. So, Craig, I think we have to run in a minute, but before we do, I think a quick wrap-up of CES again, the Consumer Electronics Show, which I was at in Las Vegas last week. We did a podcast from there with our friend and colleague, Aki Anastasiou from Talk Radio 702, last week's podcast. So if you haven't heard that, take a listen. We talk about some of the major trends that emerged, excuse me, frog in the throat, emerged from the show. I don't know what coverage you saw of the event, Craig, but for me, there were
all
really
sorts.
Two, and feel free to jump in, but there were really two trends that I picked up at CES this year. The first was the incredible advances that are happening in the television space and some of the competition we're starting to see there. And the second area I thought that we're starting to see some really interesting traction and some real excitement around is the ultrabook category. These are these thin, ultra portable laptops. Running, of course, Intel processors because it's an Intel specification.
Indeed. And of course, last year it was all about tablets, really.
This
year, tablets weren't really
a feature
at all, from what I've seen.
That's right. They certainly weren't making, there were tablets everywhere, but they weren't getting everyone talking.
No.
But let's talk just briefly about television first. I think what we're seeing is some of the most exciting developments in television since television was invented.
Absolutely incredible. Yeah.
What's happening is you're getting a computer in your lounge. An internet-connected smart device. These were always dumb terminals. Devices. You'd sit down in front of them and you'd watch something on broadcast television.
Something and tethered to some sort of peripheral. Some sort of player or signal input.
Exactly.
Or something or other. Yeah.
Now they're connected to the internet, so it just changes the dynamic. You're getting apps for televisions. You can watch. You can watch basically any content you want through streaming media services. You can do such a wide array of things, and I think the manufacturers are just at the starting gates in terms of what's going to be possible with the connected home, with the television as the center of the connected home.
And in some ways, it's bizarre that it's taken this long if you think about what we've seen in smartphones in recent years. And
yes.
This really is a sort of overlapping between smartphone functionality and televisions. And considering how much larger televisions are and the fact that they're relatively fixed comparatively, it seems bizarre that that they haven't been built in sooner.
I suppose it
was a cost factor perhaps, but they're rather high-end devices to begin with.
Yeah.
And in terms of home automation, which is also something that we can expect to see growing and becoming more popular, it seems the natural sort of hub for a connected home.
Yeah, and there was so much cool stuff. I mean, Samsung and other companies were showing off voice and gesture control televisions. This is the new generation,
right?
So literally, you could sit in front of your television, for example, and if you want to flip channels, you just motion your hand to the left as if you're brushing the screen to flick channels, and other different gestures. You could control your TV with voice, for example. So you could say, switch to ESPN, and the TV would switch to that channel. Or you could say, record this channel on this program on this channel and repeat for the season.
I wonder what it would make of my dad shouting at the news presenters.
Or the sports, or the rugby.
Or something. But this is certainly what we're seeing too, is, it's another one that I find a little bit bizarre, is that television remotes have remained relatively unchanged for years and years and years. And it's the sort of thing that's definitely due for an update. And when you see the possibilities and the popularity of things like Microsoft's, Kinect, gestures and voice, it just seems to make sense. It seems the natural evolution. But what I think is even more exciting, really, is just the panels themselves. I mean, saw what they're bringing out with are they OLEDs or OLEDs or the organic
light emitting diode technology. It's really exciting. It's in terms of display technology, this is the biggest step forward since we went from CRT to panel displays.
Plasmas,
it's arguably even more important, this switch, because this is going to enable the next generation of ultra low power and ultra thin and light.
Yeah, energy efficient and literally just hang them on the wall.
Yes, there's no LED backlighting required in these technologies. Mm. No backlighting used at all, and you get the most incredible resolution, the most incredible picture clarity, and
contrast also. You can't rival it.
It's hard to actually describe, but I saw the OLED sets from LG and Samsung on display at CES, and the picture quality was unbelievable. The TVs are expensive. You're looking at easily 80 to 100 or even more thousand rand right now. But of course, the prices are kind of come down 50% a year for the next 5 years. So.
Indeed, I was going to say give it half a decade, and that will be the norm. Will be what people buy.
It'll be the norm, absolute norm. And interestingly, at CES, the guys are still pushing 3D in a very big way.
I saw a lot of that in the coverage I picked up.
Samsung, of course, still punting active shutter technology, which is the more expensive technology.
I find it bizarre.
I don't like it personally. LG, the big competitor from Korea, is pushing the passive technology with much cheaper glasses, and I actually find it much more comfortable in my eyes, to be honest. The 3D picture might not be quite as good as what you get through the active shutter technology, but it's still good.
I think Samsung are clearly clinging to it from an output or a quality results perspective, but from a usability perspective, the LG's passive option wins hands down, having, like you know, used both. I mean, I still think 3D has an awfully long way to go before it gets out of the realm of novelty. I believe there's also some talk of glasses-free 3D, and of course that's going to get very interesting as they work out how to do multiple viewing angles. And
indeed. I saw some of it demoed. I think it was at the Toshiba stand, but I wasn't impressed with it at all. It really doesn't come anywhere near.
But it's still very early. Very early, Jen. I think the I think the passive 3D and eventually the glasses free 3D is it has to be the way things are going.
Yeah.
There's just no way that consumers are going to be prepared to wear these bulky, incredibly pricey, independently powered glasses. They're not convenient. They're not affordable, and it's just impractical. It doesn't make for a good experience. And at the end of the day, the experience is far more important than even the quality of the picture, I feel.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think Samsung has made a mistake with going for the active shutter technology, because it really is uncomfortable to wear these glasses, and it's a pain.
Well, I think the market will force them to reevaluate that in time to come, or to find ways to work around it and
to make the glasses better.
Absolutely.
Good. So before we go, I just wanted to chat a little bit about ultrabooks, which was the other big trend coming out of CES this year. We saw some really interesting machines. I've been using a MacBook for many years. I've decided to make the switch back to a Windows laptop, just because I like change every so often.
Yeah, and it's good to keep abreast of what's going on.
So I'm probably going to wait until Windows 8 comes out, probably around mid-year or the third quarter of this year, and then decide what the best machines are. But there were some really sexy ultrabooks coming out at CES this year. The ones that really caught my attention were the new Samsung Series 9, the 2012 edition.
Those are quite staggering.
Really look amazing. They're lighter than the MacBook Air.
And they feel hardy, and they feel really, really high quality. And we had the first gen one that we had to play with was really fantastic. And also, they were so nicely designed. It was really nice to see products that were just that aesthetically pleasing.
Yes.
You know, as opposed to just sort of bog standard square notebook. The other thing, of course, about these is we're going to see more of them as the price of solid-state drives come down. And I'm particularly excited about those because of the difference that makes to speed.
And battery.
And battery life, absolutely. And, aside from allowing them to last longer and be, silent and hardier, the other bonus with the SSDs is that for a while I felt like, processing power was beginning to outstrip read-write speeds.
Yes.
And, the problem with these remains how expensive they are, but that's certainly going to drop.
I didn't end up buying one, but I was keenly looking at SSD prices in the US. I can't really afford to have a replace my hard drive with an SSD of a capacity of less than 250 gigabytes.
Indeed.
And I was looking at the prices there, and they've dropped to around about the $3,000 mark for a 256 gigabyte. Sorry, $3,000. What am I saying? $300 mark. So it probably landed in South Africa at about 3,000 rand. That's come down quite significantly. And the prices are coming down as demand increases. And I think the floods in Thailand are helping, because they've pushed up the price of magnetic disk. And so that's resulting in more demand for SSDs, which is, of course, pushing the price down.
All of which is great news. It's been... The drop in SSD prices has been very slow, and I suppose that's because of lack of demand until the sort of ultrabook trend really got going. SSDs have been around for a number of years now, but they've always remained...
And the capacity has been too small. That's been the real challenge.
And prohibitively expensive, but the capacity is a huge issue. My current laptop has a I think 120 gig drive, and it's really difficult. You know, we forget now how much data we expect to be able to carry around with us at any time. Even just music and photo collections are the problem. But yeah, the Ultrabooks, the other thing, of course, is SSDs are great when you're coupling them with something like USB 3 or other high-speed transfer systems, and we're seeing more and more of that. You know, I'm always amazed now when we get Ultrabooks or ultra-portable laptops to review that don't include one. Mm. I just think, you know, if I was in the market like you to purchase one, that would be a given. Aside from the fact that it's, you know, more and more devices are going to be supporting it, it's a future-proofing measure. If I were to buy one now, I would want some sort of high-speed connection. I just wouldn't settle for plain USB 2s.
No.
Particularly absolutely. As none of these include optical drives, and, you know, those sort of connections are becoming the de facto way to shift data other than wireless.
Yeah. Well, these Ultrabooks we saw at CES all have at least one USB 3 port, right. So we are moving in that direction. Interestingly, a lot of them ship with one USB 3 and one USB 2 port. I'm not sure why they do that. It must have something to do with the cost of the USB technology at the stage, the USB 3 technology at the stage. But
one of the other things I have seen that I've liked is when they include an eSATA and USB in one port.
Yes.
I think that's
Sony does that.
That's a great move and something that I'm surprised we don't see more more of. But certainly a sort of sector to watch. And I think this first generation of devices have a little way to go. I think when Windows 8 comes out, which is clearly aimed at a combination of sort of tablets and desktop or laptop devices, I think if I was in the market for one now, I would certainly be waiting until at least the middle of this year, by which time we'll have the second and even in some cases possibly third generations out, and hopefully we'll have worked out some of the kinks.
Yeah, for sure. The laptop or the Ultrabook that won the Best of CES award was the Acer S5, which I had a look at. Quite a nice device. I think it was all black, so it was quite sexy. And then the one that really got a lot of journalists' attention was the Lenovo Yoga, which is an odd name for a machine, but I guess it gets its name from its flexibility because when it's closed, it looks just like a regular Ultrabook.
Mm.
But you open it up, you flip the screen around 180 degrees, and it turns into a Windows 8 tablet.
Right. Yes, I think that sort of thing. I think we're going to see a lot more of that as well, and a combination of touch displays, particularly when you look at the popularity of tablets like the Asus Transformer, that essentially, you know, is a touchscreen netbook come ultra portable. I think we're going to see a lot more integration of touch screens in what were traditionally sort of laptop form factors.
Yeah, I think with specifically with Windows 8 and its touch interface coming, you're going to see a lot of interesting moves around creating Ultrabook tablet combinations in one.
Absolutely. I have to explain this to my mother, who I remember when I was in my school days always used to moan at me for touching the screen because of leaving greasy fingerprints.
Right, yes.
Lastly, I suppose we should really talk about the other big news this week, which was SOPA and the various website responses to the bill that hopefully won't make it into law in the US.
Yeah, indeed. I haven't looked at it in a great deal of detail, but our colleague Alistair Fairweather wrote a great column about it today, looking at how the internet is really starting to put real pressure on governments. We saw the Arab Spring last year, how the internet and communication technology helped overthrow some of those governments. But Alistair makes the good point that the internet is now, openness on the internet, which the US government has always promoted, has kind of come back and bit them in the ass on this one because they were really the US lawmakers were really pushing this anti-piracy legislation called SOPA and PIPA, which I forget what it stands for there. SOPA stands for this... I also forget.
Stop Online Piracy Act.
That's
the one, yeah.
Yes, and I have no idea what PIPA stands for. Protection of Intellectual Property Act or something like that.
I think we've worked it out. One interesting line of argument I've heard from some people, and but perhaps they're being alarmist though, is that there are some concerns that these are red herrings, and that there is actually other bills and other plans sort of behind the scenes, that these are merely getting people riled up, but there are actually subtler and more sinister legislation sort of in the pipeline. But I'm not quite sure what to make of it. Either way, I just think it's interesting in terms of the response from the online community. And of course, Wikipedia blacking out for a day, Wikipedia being one of the sort of top five most visited web pages, at least in the English world. It's amazing to see sites like that throwing their weight behind the opposition to these bills.
Indeed, Google too had a link on its homepage. WordPress was blacked out, or I think partially blacked out.
Reddit, Wired magazine,
quite a few of them. So it was quite a powerful protest, and they collected millions of signatures in total through the protest action around it. And the US government appears to be backing off to some extent now.
And we can only hope it stays that way. Yeah.
Anyway, on that note, we have to run. So, we do. Thanks for listening to the show. As always, if you've got any feedback, you can send us an email at info@techcentral.co.za. Alternatively, you can leave a comment below this post. Until next time, from Craig and myself, have a great week. Cheers. Mm-hmm.